Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the At-Tajir program on Radio Islam International. The time now has gone 11 minutes past 9. A few very interesting topics that we will be discussing this morning on the At-Tajir program. Before we go to that, let us welcome Mufti Muhammad Hafiz. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Mulana Ibrahim Daya, and to all the listeners of Radio Islam International. Nice surprise today.
Yes, a very nice surprise also to have you in the studio. It's very pleasant to have you in studio.
Alhamdulillah, Mulana. You know, I'm getting cold feet because I'm so terrified with all those questions you put to the listeners. And they just have no answers and just can't come right. So I'm very, very terrified. I'm actually getting cold feet whether I should carry on or not. Or just hand over to you.
I think the cold feet is from the weather outside, Mulana. Okay, well, just let's go straight into it. That we start with the consumer highlights, and the first thing that we discuss is home ownership, the implicit cost, and to be ready for.
Yes, Mulana, home ownership is something that is desirable for many. The difficulty is that the vast majority don't just simply afford a home, and it's not a purchase that we go into on a regular basis. Even those who do enjoy the privilege, by and large, most people tend to own a single residence in their entire lifetime. But be that as it may, when it comes to purchasing a home, the key aspect is not just the cost of the home to keep in mind. There are other costs that need to be considered when having to purchase a home. And I suppose for purposes of this discussion, I'm just looking at some of the most basic costs. There are many others that we've touched on in the past, the one is obviously utility fees. When it comes to, when I talk about utilities, you're talking about water and electricity every month. So a person should not only be budgeting for the monthly payment towards the house, it's also water and electricity fees. A telephone fees. You know, you have to have a telephone, especially if you are married. You have to have a telephone. And the third one is also internet. You know, internet has become a key aspect of our lives, and especially for young families with children and so forth. So internet is a cost. That's another minimum cost. And that's apart from just the property itself. So one is you have utility fees, then you have rates and taxes, levies, etc., depending on the value of the property itself. But it can range anywhere between a couple of 100 rands to a few thousand rand every month. So it's something to keep in mind. And your rates and taxes, rates and levies, you would usually be covering aspects like your road maintenance, street light maintenance, refuse collection, and the like. But it's important to keep in mind that these are additional costs that you need to consider or factor into your budget when calculating whether one can afford the purchase of a home. I found it very interesting, Marana, that Nedbank have created a buyer's guide. There's actually a buyer's guide which provides a step-by-step explanation and offers all the information that you need to go about purchasing immovable property in the form of a primary residence. So that's an interesting tool that listeners may find useful. It's offered by Nedbank, and if anyone is interested, I could make the link available telephonically on the office number, which is 011-373-8000.
Okay. JazakAllah for that. And we move on that the signs of shady technology investments.
Well, I'm sure you've had this experience, and many listeners have probably had this experience where you get someone phoning you and saying that, you know, we have this new wonderful opportunity to invest and put your money with us. And sometimes it can even be a friend, someone you know at a masjid or at work, maybe saying, you know, put your money with me. Because of your reliance on this individual, you might just go ahead and sign up. You know, and given the tough economic climate, you find that people are looking for opportunities to make quick money. And that's another topic altogether. But for now, I just want to talk about this increase or spike in these financial investments, technology investments, rather, where you're investing in some kind of technology. And based on your understanding or overall exposure to the news that technology is an emerging trend and it's something that is likely to give good returns, you tend to fall for it. Right? But there are a few signs. Number one is, if the service or technology investment being advertised is not available on a Google search, it is already one sign of a scam. So if you put it into Google, that same name that you're being told about, if you put it into Google and it doesn't yield a positive result, in that case, a person would have to then regard that as some kind of flag already. The second one is, if the entity is unknown to you, you know, it's possibly a shell company. You just haven't heard about it before. It just sounds too strange to be true. And that is also another second flag. And the third flag for just about any investment, not only technology investments, is where they tell you, act now. If you do it now, you will see yield benefits. If you don't do it now, the price is going up in 24 hours. That kind of thing is already another flag for people to be careful of. In terms of general overall investment opportunities, I would personally caution anyone to stay away if there is a little or no paperwork involved. Absolutely no paperwork. You just give your money to us and you sign this one piece of paper. You know, that's it. Or even nothing to sign. It becomes, that's already another flag. So that's the second, the fourth one. And the final one is, if the, generally with any investment, if it's a registered investment, it would need to have a prospectus. The company would need to issue a prospectus. If that prospectus cannot be given to you as an investor, you should already be staying away. Because that prospectus is basically outlining the investment, there is a registration number, and all of the legalities that go with hosting an investment would need to be outlined in that prospectus. There would need to be contact numbers of people. It's an important document for you as an investor. So if you are going the route of official registered investments, which are FSB compliant, these are just a few points that I've mentioned in terms of flags when it comes to assessing the validity of these investments.
It's important that you mention the move to that of paperwork as well, that even if it is someone that you know, someone that you, even family sometimes, paperwork is important and to have everything in writing.
It is important, Morana, and that is a fundamental Quranic injunction, which many people have heard about and ulama have emphasized in the past. But many a time in our experience, people just take it for granted. It's my brother, it's my father, you know, it's nothing will go wrong. If it goes wrong, I'll just let it go, you know. And then when it's crunch time, you find that the amount you've got to let go is so vast, that so huge, you just can't let it go. You've got to claim your right in some way, and you've got nothing to fall back onto.
That's so important to have that paperwork. It also, later what happens is that it can become a family problem, and we have heard of such experiences. So important to have everything in paperwork and have everything written down. So moving along, that one thing that has been covered in the news over the past few weeks or even months is the fees must fall campaign. And what is the parents' biggest concern with this?
This is a very relevant question and a thorny issue in the media as of this morning as well. And we find that from an Islamic perspective, this is a common area. We've all got this concern. Our parents who are affected by this protest action are basically concerned that we have made payments. We've settled our bill for the year maybe, or even for the current semester, whatever the requirements are. We've settled our bill in terms of tuition fees. But we have not received any services. What is going to happen? If the academic program does resume, do we have to be paying again? Or do we have to be, or even next year if the program continues? If my child has to go back to university, what will be happening then? I'm not going to provide any conclusive evidence or anything, but I just want to make one important point before I go ahead. The first thing is, we are touching on a fiqh aspect of the Fees Must Fall campaign. However, it should be emphasized, and we should keep in mind that the issue of Fees Must Fall should not be viewed primarily from a fiqh lens. This is a political issue, and a political strategy needs to be adopted in dealing with the problem. Mm. That's a separate issue. For purposes of our discussion now, we are just looking at the fiqh element of the fees that have been paid in, and what is the concern of parents.
Yes.
So legally, as well as from South African legal perspective, as well as Islamic perspective, if during the term of a contract there are unforeseen natural circumstances due to which the service provider cannot perform, it's totally out of their control to perform. There's an earthquake, or there's massive floods, or protest action of this sort, where there's damage to property and risk of life. In that case, the service provider is unable to perform. Usually, in legal terms, as well as this is one area where Islamic law is and the South African law are common, in the sense that the terms of the contract are suspended, and then they will resume whenever it is possible to resume. In essence, what this means is that from an Islamic perspective and from our current understanding of the South African law, it is most likely the case that people will not have to be paying once again or coughing up further funds in order to continue with the academic program. I hope that is the case, and we are looking forward to, I suppose, if there's some kind of events unfolding in the future, we'll come to know about it. But in terms of the law, in terms of what we're currently aware of, and Islamic law, there seems to be current ground that if there is a legitimate basis for not being able to perform on the contract, the terms are suspended until it is possible to deliver on those terms.
Yes, JazakAllah khair for that. Now we continue, Muftis Abdat, signs of a decent loyalty program.
Oh, Marana, I'm sure if you open your wallet, you have many, many loyalty program cards. Because I'm not sure how loyal you are as a consumer, but loyalty programs have become the order of the day. I mean, many people, there's now talk of these loyalty programs being taxed by SARS. There's also talk of a common loyalty platform where you'll carry one card and then all 500, there's currently about 160, 180 programs in the country. That's alone quite staggering. But all of them being linked to one card. So you carry one card or one device and that's what your points get allocated according to the programs you've signed up for. But be that as it may, I think when it comes to signing up for any loyalty program, the key aspect, and this goes without saying, you don't even need a mufti to be saying this, but the loyalty program needs to be compliant with Sharia principles. That is a given, and it's we can't dispute it. So you've got to assess Sharia compliance before you go ahead. The second thing is that when it comes to businesses making this offering of loyalty programs, according to experts, if the business service or goods are so unique that it does not require a loyalty program, then there is no need for a loyalty program. The service is unique itself. It speaks for itself, and it invites consumers on its own. Yes. In that case, there is no need to offer a loyalty program. However, if there is stiff competition, like in supermarkets, like in airlines, there would probably be a need for a loyalty program. What I want to do in response to your question, Molana, is provide some basic signs of a decent loyalty program. So in addition to Sharia compliance, these are the signs. Number one is the conversion in terms of those points that you accrue is simple to understand. It's straightforward and makes sense. So let's take an example. Let's say they tell you that you swipe this card and you'll earn 10 points for on your swipe. Mm-hmm. Those 10 points are equivalent to 1 rand, and 20 rands will give you 50% discount of your next purchase. So it's like, it's convoluted there. Do you really understand that? It's actually more of a headache, because you spend 20 rand to get you'll get 20 points, will be 1 rand, and then that you'll need to accumulate that 1 rand that many times to qualify for your next purchase. So it's complicated. It's tough to actually accumulate that much of points to qualify for your benefit. So you must be able to understand the breakdown or accumulation of points. How does it happen? That's number one. Number two is, are there tiers in the program? So example, level 1, level 2, level 3, on what level of earning are you? Because if everyone is in the same category, the benefit to the consumer is not, in real terms, is not there. There isn't a real benefit to the consumers if everyone is together on the same platform. So your loyalty is rewarded based on the degree to which you engage that specific service, and the more you engage that service, the more higher you climb. So there should be some kind of tier process. And the third and final sign of a decent loyalty program is, do they have partners in that loyalty program? Because if they have partners, the chances of you as a consumer benefiting is much more. You can gain from your loyalty points that you've earned, and you can spend it elsewhere, not only with the specific service provider that you're engaging with. So that's also important. It just makes, it creates more credibility and gives the specific loyalty offering a more greater clout in terms of people signing up and becoming an attraction because of the wide range of services that people can engage in signing up for that loyalty program. So these are just, I think I would suffice on saying four signs. Number one is Sharia compliance. Number two is the conversion simple and you are able to understand it? Number three, is it tiered? And number four, do they have loyalty partners?
That's interesting there, and no doubt to understand that conversion of points. You know, recently I received a message that I have like 30,000 points, and I was like excited, and then I found out it's like 3 rand or something. But carrying on, where do South African consumers spend their financial windfall?
UCT Unilever Institute basically carried out an 18-month survey of 8,000 South Africans across 5 different groups. Now that's complicated, right? So we've got this company carrying out a survey for 18 months, speaking to 8,000 South Africans over 5 income groups, and they asked them a single question. They asked them that if you were to get your salary multiplied by 3, so 3 months of your salary were to be given to you enjoy a financial windfall, what would you do with it? These were the preferences in descending order. This is what consumers said. Some of them, the vast majority, said the first thing, they will invest the money. Number two, save it in a bank. Number three, pay off debts. Number four, start a business. Number five, buy household goods. Number six, That's when I find God's taking away. Why is number six only? Is to help someone else. Right? Number seven, to treat themselves. Number eight, to put a deposit on a house. Number nine, to go on holiday. And number 10, to put a deposit on a car. Now, the idea is not to talk about what would people do in terms of the financial windfall, in terms of their response to the question, right? It goes without saying that by and large, most people would want to take the nest egg and invest it. And yeah, that is why that's the first preference. Or even save it, right? That is the second preference. The most striking part is two points. Number one is that according to the study that was done, the survey by UCT Unilever Institute, three quarters of South Africans survive on between 1,000 and 3,000 rand a month. Three quarters of South African citizens, right? And just 3% earn more than 30,000 rand a month. Only 3% earn above 30,000 rand a month. Can you imagine the severe condition South African citizens find themselves in? And there's a spiritual root cause to the problem. There's also a strategic root cause to the problem in terms of our inability to improve our situation. That's one aspect. The second aspect in terms of the survey was that according to these 8,000 South Africans that were spoken to or participant in the survey, 38% felt that they are being subjected to what we call black tax. 38% of them. What is black tax? Black tax is basically a form of expenditure that you as a consumer have to absorb due to having to look after someone else. So you're looking after maybe someone in your family, and as a result, it's placing a strain on your finances.
Mm.
Now, for these individuals, 38% saying that they are falling prey to black tax, right? And according to this 38%, 20% of their income is basically being used to support someone in their family, right? For me as a person, I don't see this as straightforward as it is in terms of the survey carried out. Because for us as Muslims, we believe that, in the words of Nabi sallallahu alaihi wasallam, "Innama turzakuna wa tunsaruna bi du'afaikum." Your wealth and the aid of Allah Ta'ala comes to you through the weak and the feeble individuals. Allah Ta'ala provides rizq for you through them.
Mm.
So it's not that you must avoid having to look after someone, maybe a parent, maybe someone who is sick. You shouldn't avoid it because of the theory of managing finances, that this is going to be placing you under strain and so forth. For us, our risk is ultimately from Allah Ta'ala, and our risk is not through our own ability. It's through those weak individuals. So our orientation on these kind of surveys has to be looked at from an Islamic perspective.
Yes. Jazakumullah khairan for that. The time now, 29 minutes past the hour of 9. We take a short break, and inshallah, when we come back, we will be speaking to Rehan Chatham, and he is the founder of the popcorn shop that has opened up in Rosebank Mall. Stay tuned to Radio Islam International. Yes, welcome back to the Tajir program on Radio Islam International on this Tuesday morning. The time now, 28 minutes to the hour of 10, and we have Mufti Muhammad Hafiji in studio with us, and we will be joined now by Rehan Chatham, who is the founder of Maverick and Jane, the popcorn stall there at the zone in Rosebank.
Malam Ibrahim, globally, popcorn has become a mainstream snack alternative. It is widely perceived as better than sugary alternatives. And as a result, a number of artisanal popcorn companies have opened shop across the US and UK in recent years. Global research group Euromonitor International has forecast the global popcorn sector to grow to 10.3 billion rand by 2018, from about 8 billion currently. Now, Maverick and Jane is a recently established gourmet popcorn enterprise based in the zone in Rosebank, and we are fortunate to have the founder, Rehan Chatham, to talk to us about his new venture. Now, before I welcome Brother Rehan, let me just inform the listeners that Brother Rehan is a qualified chartered accountant who is under 30, has spent 6 years in the UAE, where he spent time at Al Hilal Bank and was exposed to the Abu Dhabi Vision 2030, and is currently at Barclays in South Africa in his capacity as Vice President of Group Financial Decision Support. Now, Brother Rehan Chatham, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you so much for having me on your show.
You're most welcome. Brother Rehan, can you firstly tell us what inspired you to give popcorn a makeover?
Before I do that, I must correct you. I wish I was that young, but I'm actually 35.
Sure. I'm young.
Giving myself a false sense of hope there. No, I'm kidding. I think it was just a passion. Like you said, I was abroad for 6 years. A large part of my mandate was helping the Abu Dhabi government build businesses in the UAE and outside the UAE, and obviously at a much larger scale.
Mm.
during one of those journeys and acquisitions, our mandate was to to acquire grain lands and maize lands across the globe. Abu Dhabi being a desert, or UAE rather, you know, they needed some sort of self-sustaining. If there's a global crisis, how do you get food into the Emirates? So one of the proactive measures was the establishment of a UAE National Security Food Security Force, which would see, would make sure that the UAE at any given time has at least 2 years' worth of food supplies on hand. There's inroads and logistics to get the food there, and at least 2 years silo or grain in silos need to be available in the UAE. Then the next step was that, listen, what happens if the time horizons, you know, go past 2 years? And unfortunately, if you look in the Middle East, a lot of the countries in turmoil go well beyond 2 years, 3 years. So the next best thing was, listen, we need to acquire our own farmland and we need to have, you know, partnership agreements. And that's how I came across, you know, the fine Nebraskan corn.
Okay.
That together with a bit of fashion, I thought, you know, we could put together a gourmet popcorn boutique.
Interesting. Tell me something, where does the name Maverick and Jane come from? Where do you derive that from?
Sure. I think if there's something that troubled me in the project was actually finding a suitable name. It really has both a metaphorical spin on it as well as factual. You know, if the factual spin is that the farm that we acquire our grain from belonged to A. Jane. She took over her dad's farm in the early 1900s. So we still source farm from, you know, one of the old, well-established farms in Nebraska. Mm-hmm. Jane was very much an adventurer. She was very proactive, foresight, and she married a Maverick. His name was something else.
Okay.
We found it befitting to write them into our story because we like their values. You know, their values were a life of ambition, endless opportunity, you know, that type of thing. Hence our tagline, Choose Adventure.
Okay, gourmet popcorn is definitely in the food category, right? I just want to know, for interest sake, do you see halal certification as a religious obligation rather than a bargaining chip to attract customers?
You know, it's, initially when we opened, we didn't think we'd go with the halal certification. It is Muslim owned, Muslim run.
Yes.
Everything is handmade by myself and my father who's joined me in my business. And, you know, like you said, I'm at Barclays in a certain capacity. So he's really the retail veteran, and he's running with the day-to-day operations. He's well, very well known in the community. He was there in the founding stages of a lot of the halal authorities in SA.
Mm-hmm.
And popcorn is quite basic. It's pure stuff that goes in. You know, it's butter, it's milk, it's sugar, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Having said that, now we are getting a lot of inquiries from large corporates and international firms where they require it because of legal obligation, mm-hmm. or, you know, that type of thing. And possibly then we would go for certification.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, these days when it comes to some ingredients being utilized to line cans, it becomes all the more important to consider that aspect. But be that as it may, and we wish you all the best for that part of it. I just want to know, you know, you are in a very significant commercial location. We need advice from you to other SMEs in terms of the secret behind negotiating rental in a mall.
Yeah, so we struggled. Despite all the experience or, you know, the concepts that you might want to put forward, I was ready with this concept more than a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
I already started pitching, and I visited malls around the country, pitched our plan to them. And you know, that was probably a little bit of the thing that I do in my day to day, was drafting up the business plans and showing them that this would be the journey, you know, from Nebraska right down to the box of popcorn we'd serve in store.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of malls were very skeptical. There were two big hurdles that we needed to cross. One was getting the farmers in Nebraska on board, because it's a massive process to bring the corn from Nebraska to South Africa.
Okay.
So one, getting the farmers on board, two, getting the local health authorities on board, and then the third part was getting more to buy into the concept. So that was not easy, you know, by any stroke of imagination.
Mm-hmm.
But alhamdulillah, we did get an opportunity with the zone, and with Allah's grace and mercy, it's been going really well since then. After that, now more have been approaching us across the country.
Okay, so there is an expansion plan in place. Is that what you're saying also?
Yeah, 100% actively being pursued already.
Okay.
It's just now, you know, the actual timing and that type of thing, you know, how we actually go about it.
Mm. Brother Rehan, you've talked about Nebraska in terms of your corn. Why import grain from Nebraska out of all places?
No, 100%. So I like how you pose your question. Why? And if I just pause on the why, our personal ambition is to source everything locally eventually. We'd love to. You know, a big part of our drive is commitment to South Africa. You touched on the Abu Dhabi 2030 vision. It's one of the reasons I came back to South Africa. We actually have a very similar plan. Not everyone has bought into it. It's the South Africa National Development Plan, also 2030. A lot of the key milestones in there are sort of raising or reducing unemployment, something that's written into our strategy. I think six out of eight now, seven out of nine actually of our employees in our first store who previously didn't have jobs. That was a big drive for us. And same on the supplier side. The reason why we go all the way to Nebraska is we sample corn, you know, across the globe in previous former, you know, lives. And the Nebraskan corn, firstly, when it pops, it pops to a larger size, known as expansion rate in, you know, the popcorn world. Mm-hmm. What comes with that is a better taste, a better texture, better mouthfeel, and also the brown part on the inside doesn't catch your throat. As, you know, some other popcorn varieties, you find that if you eat some popcorn, you'll cough, you know, after 2 or 3 years. And then we're used to it because that's the corn we eat here. Mm-hmm. That might still happen, but to a far less degree. Mm-hmm. So the taste profile has improved. The one thing I'd like to highlight, it's not genetically modified in any way. A lot of the corn that does come out of the U.S. is GMO. Ours is non-GMO.
Hmm, interesting. Okay, now, in what way would you say you make a difference to the lives of your ordinary employees?
Okay, so the first thing was we interviewed a whole lot of people. Our preference was to give jobs to people who didn't have jobs. People that did have jobs, it was good for them, so that was the first thing. So a lot of people now are employed, a lot of them have kids, have families, so, you know, that's already making a difference in their lives. We're already looking at progression plans within the staff. We just had a meeting on Sunday, and with some of those new sites, you know, starting to come to fruition slowly, we're already identifying people that will take senior roles, and, you know, that doesn't happen. I mean, we're only on board for 2 months, and that's like, you know, super fast, you know. We're talking to people and saying that, listen, you're going to be responsible for this, and you're going to be responsible for that. And this is like a baby team. You know, if the baby team performs well, they'll always be seen in a good light. You know, everyone who comes after this now will be second, third, fourth, you know. Still close to the core, but this is the founding team, you know. That's the first thing. The second thing is what we have written into our plans, inshallah, is to try and help them with the education at some stage in their life. So, you know, we don't want to hold on to them. We want them to progress. Some of them want to progress internally and do the journey with us. That's fabulous. Still, education will be required. If they want to go out there, we can see how we can start partnering up with them, you know, to help them further their professional, their personal ambition. Then it really ties back to the brand, life of endless opportunity.
Brother Han, I have one final question, man. You know, asymmetric information is a core concept in commerce, right? In this regard, I suppose accountants probably have the best exposure to a wide range of businesses, and you see across the spectrum just about everything. Now, would you agree that from all professions, they are the best suited to run with an idea without actually stealing someone else's concept?
I think it really depends on the individual. Certainly your professional background might help, but I wouldn't say that accountants or CA are best suited, not at all. I think, you know, it's really passion, which everyone has within them. It's that willingness to cross the boundary.
Yes.
To wanting to go. In fact, if you look at a lot of the founding fathers in our communities in South Africa, they didn't go past standard 3. They've done stuff to our country which we only dream of doing in the next 20 years. Right down from community levels, building masjids, schooling. This is like core infrastructure without education. So, look, professional definitely will help, but definitely not, for me, not even in the top few.
Brother Rehan Jatham, thank you so much for your time. Jazakallah khair, and we wish you everything of the best for the future.
Jazakallah, thanks so much for having me on your show.
You're most welcome. That was Brother Rehan Jatham from Maverick and Jane, the Gourmet Popcorn Store in the Zone at Rosebank. And a very fascinating interview, Molana. All credit of that interview goes to Brother Imtiaz Wadia, who put us on to Rehan. And very impressive, Molana. I cherish the point he makes about the fact that our forefathers were uneducated and did so much and brought us to where we are today. And it can be done by the current generation as well. All it takes is just some kind of determination and drive to move forward. That stands out for me. And number two is just the fact that I don't know if I haven't yet been to the store, but 7 out of 9 being unemployed and suddenly now got employment in a small way, making a difference to the lives of people, which is an important component and duty of a Muslim, for indeed we have come to give and not to take. So I do find it very interesting. I'm not too sure what your impressions are, Mullah.
Yes, no doubt that final point that you made there, that 7 out of the 9 were unemployed. And also he speaks about that he he has this vision or this intention to further and to empower them and upskill them with giving them education if they want to continue. So it's something that it's been done for a lot of times we speak and but yeah, it's something that is actively being done to better the situation.
The progression plan stands out, man. Really, if you think about a business just in existence for 2 months and already talking about the current staff complement being given some kind of progression for the future, those are favorable good things and indicators that the business is on the right path. I sincerely wish everything of the best for Brother Rehan and his family who are involved in driving this small business enterprise.
Yes, no doubt we make dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala further and grant them barakah in that business dealings of them.
Amen.
Yes, we continue now with we go to the last segment of the program, and that is the Fiqh of Commerce.
Fiqh of Commerce on the At-Tajir Hour with Mufti Muhammad Hafiji.
Yes, this is the final segment of the program, and Mufti Saab, that last week it was spoken about the three interesting motivations for giving a gift and also the two reasons to reject a gift.
This was a very fascinating discussion we had last week in terms of some of the motivations that are involved in individuals giving gifts. The first motivation that we had talked about just in a nutshell was that where you give a gift and it's purely no strings attached. You know, you give the gift purely out of the goodness of your heart and to get some personal fulfillment, some reward in the year, world in the year after, and also to give joy to the recipient of the gift. That's the best approach to the giving of any gift, and it tends to yield the best form of results because of the clarity of the intention. The second motivation we had looked at last week was that sometimes gifts are given. This does happen, where individuals give gifts to derive some kind of benefit, either in the form of a physical, tangible exchange. So I'm giving you this item now, and maybe in a few months' time you'll give me something,
Yes.
Or you're going for Umrah now, I'll give you 100 rand and 500 rand, but it will come back, man. When you come back, you'll bring me something, You just, you don't say it, but you're expecting it, And that's also something, a motivation which tends to be prevalent. Also, the issue where you give gifts to earn some praise. This man has got a good heart. He always gives people gifts. And, that kind of reputation must be built. Also, a bit of a problem. And then the third motivation we had looked at was the aspect of giving a gift to repel the evil of a person. Sometimes you have you know that someone can inflict harm on you. And in that, just to quell or to suppress that harm, a gift is given just to keep that person at bay. To build a relationship, that is also a legitimate form of gifting. It is recognized in the Sharia, and it is indeed part of what you can call, if you really look at it, this is strategy. This is not just going and backbiting that this person hates me and does this to me and does that to me. Many a time our perception about other people is built on the informed the pieces of information we receive from others. So, for example, you're having supper and someone will tell you, this person, stay away from him, very bad, don't go near this lady, don't go near this one here, don't sit with her, don't phone her. But then we don't work on improving that relationship. And here's one way to do it. Sometimes giving of a gift can have that profound impact of building that relationship and discovering that person for yourself rather than depending on information given by others. So those were the three motivations for the gift. And in terms of our discussion on the two reasons to reject a gift, we had emphasized that accepting of a gift is sunnah. By the very nature of it being sunnah, rejection of a gift is possible. It is possible to reject a gift. One motivation would be that the item being given is prohibited. The item itself is prohibited. It's haram. In that case, that kind of gift can be rejected. And the second one is where as the recipient of the gift, that the giftor, the one who's giving the gift, is intending to give the gift and derive some unfair advantage from giving the gift. And this is not some suspicion. You have some almost certainty that the person giving the gift is doing it with an ulterior motive. In that case, there is some leeway for rejecting the gift. However, one needs to be very careful about it. We are just discussing the theory of how people can reject a gift, but it doesn't necessarily mean you must be suspicious and harbor those forms of suspicion to reject a gift.
Yes, and continuing with the topic of gifts, and we look at this week, we carry on with the discussion, looking at the pillars of a valid gift.
Well, if our listeners will recall, we've started the discussion on Fiqh of Commerce with the basic laws of sale. And
yes.
The reason was, the motivation then was that the importance of understanding the basic rules of sale just the bay itself, underpin every other transaction in Islamic law. So that is why it needed to come first. So many of those rules which we, I think we spent about 1.5 years discussing, just the sale itself, not even leasing, not even giving a security, just the sale itself, spent about 1.5 years. So we looked at discussion of the basic concepts or precepts that need to be applied in a transaction. And those same rules will apply to a gift. In your question of a pillar of a gift, one of the key important pillars of a gift is the offer and acceptance, which we in our understanding of commercial transactions, this aspect of a gift having a component or a pillar of offer and acceptance is virtually absent in our community. So many a time you'll find a person giving a gift, but there's no acceptance of it. The recipient doesn't even know that they've received this gift. So you'll get a mother telling her husband that, a lady telling her husband that this jewelry is for my children. But the children have no clue that the jewelry is for them.
Yes.
And only upon one of them, someone passing away, do we find out now there's some circumstances that need to be investigated and looked at and so forth. Similarly with immovable property. Sometimes a person will register an immovable property on the name of the son.
Yes.
It will be done for tax purposes maybe. In addition to tax purposes, maybe the father's intention is to actually gift it to the son.
Yes.
But he doesn't actually ever say it. He never actually told his son or even any other family member that this house or this outhouse or this portion of the house is belonging to my son. He doesn't ever say it. And now, after father is deceased, it becomes a problem. So the offer and acceptance is important. It is touched on by virtually all the fuqaha in terms of its importance of the offer and acceptance. Keep in mind, why is an offer and acceptance required in a gift? Because the Sharia recognizes the ownership of a person. If you, Mulana Ibrahim, are the owner of a specific item, the Sharia gives you some kind of sanctity to that ownership. It's your item. Nobody can take it away from you unlawfully. So because of the sanctified nature of your ownership, the Sharia requires you to mutually agree to having to part with your ownership. So you'll have to make an offer, and someone will have to accept that offer. So the sanctity of the ownership is respected, and that ownership moves from one person to another. So that is one of the most important reasons why the offer and acceptance is required, because of the sanctity of that ownership. The second important aspect to keep in mind is that there's a difference here between the offer and acceptance in a transaction, a normal sale, and the offer and acceptance in a gift scenario. The difference is, people might think we're talking about legalities here, but these are issues we've never been exposed to in terms of our fundamental education of commerce. So the first thing to keep in mind, the main difference is that in a transaction of sale, you just offer, I'll offer you to sell you my computer, for example, and you'll accept it.
Mm.
But the item is in my bag and it's still in my house.
Yes.
That transaction is done. It's basically done. You are the owner of the item. Mm. That's in the case of sale. In the case of gifting, this is a very different case, because when you offer someone to give them a gift, that person has to accept it. That's not the end of the transaction.
Mm.
The transaction is only completed when you take possession of the item.
Okay.
So this is why in scenarios where people say the gold coins are yours, or the jewelry necklace, that chain set is yours, and I'm leaving it, I have it with me. You know.
Right.
So the gift is that child may have accepted it, said yes, jazakallah, I appreciate it, and you shouldn't have done it, but I'll let you use it when you're going to some function or something, you know. Typical scenario, but possession has never ever taken place. That recipient of the gift never ever held that piece of jewelry, doesn't even know where it is maybe.
Mm.
It may be locked in a safe and they have absolutely no access to the safe. No access. So in that case, the whole validity of the gift is brought into question now, because there's been an offer and acceptance, but possession represents completion of that gift. So the very fundamental difference between the offer and acceptance in the case of a sale and the offer and acceptance when it comes to a gift. Those are just some of the basic precepts in terms of the first pillar of a gift, the offer and acceptance.
Yes, and that of taking possession. As you were speaking about this, I remembered one incident that few months back or something, one of my aunties wanted to give something to her niece, and the same thing that happens generally, that, you know, take the jewelry or something like that, and she gave her the jewelry, but she said, no, take it. in your possession. Okay. And then when once you took it and she put it on, then my aunt, the auntie said that, now can I borrow it back from you?
Oh, okay.
So something like that. Just keeping in mind that.
Yes, and those are complicated areas that come about. In terms of our exposure to some of the laws of gifting, when it comes to giving of gift, there's another aspect which I want to touch on in terms of giving the gift on a conditional basis. That is one aspect. In terms of your specific scenario there, in the case where the recipient of the gift has voluntarily said, you know what,
yeah,
I don't mind if you use it, I'm willing to let you use it, or you can, you know, you've given me this house, but as long as you are alive, you can stay in it, I don't mind. It's a separate contract. So
yes,
the two are not linked or not suspended on each other, where I'm giving you this house on condition you let me stay in it till I pass away. And after I pass away, at least your mother must be able to stay in it, then it becomes yours.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of the contracts should be separated. The gift is one, and the use of rakto, being allowed to use the item, is another contract which we have deeds drawn up for individuals to make use of.
Yes, the time now, 6 minutes to the hour, can we come to the end of the program? Mufti Saab, just some closing comments maybe from your side.
Yes, Marana, it has been very fulfilling going through some of these aspects of commercial affairs that have come up in recent times. I think we've just got to be overly concerned about this whole issue of fees must fall. It is indeed a very thorny debate that is raging, and something that needs to be addressed. And if a government continues to fail in many other aspects of life, we are going to find or see much more of these kind of phenomenon where people are up in arms about service delivery. In terms of the SME interview profile we had, I'm just impressed that someone is taking the move. And what I like is the individual is not in a comfort zone of just sitting in the corporate office, and the corporate life eventually can get to you. There are many other opportunities out there that people can pursue. And finally, in terms of these fiqh of commerce and the laws of gifting, gifting is such a widespread practice. But I really deem it very important for individuals to be equipped with the laws of gifting. It's not a simple procedure. We shouldn't take it for granted. There are complicated rules when it comes to these gifts, which are maybe suspended on death, given in lifetime but no possession. Very complicated area, and in practice we are seeing some quite disconcerting scenarios which are cause for concern in terms of our laws, our knowledge of gifting.
Yes, Jazakumullah khair, and we come to the end to the end of the program, and Jazakumullah khair for joining us, and Assalamu alaikum. We hope to have you next week again.
Inshallah, I look forward to it. It has been a pleasure being here, and I make dua that our listeners have benefited. If there is anything unclear, I may be contacted on 011-373-8000 or even the email address ecofin@islamsa.org.za.
Yes, Jazakumullah. For myself, Ibrahim Dyer, and our studio operator this morning, Ziad, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.